Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Leave it to Reparation H, Vice President Kamala Harris, to politicize the response to the devastation inflicted by Hurricane Ian. It's climate change on the front end and race on the back end. Here's what Kamala said about the prioritization of aid to those affected.
It is our lowest income communities and our communities of color that are most impacted by these extreme conditions and impacted by issues that are not of their own making.
And so women.
Absolutely. And so we have to address this in a way that is about giving resources based on equity, understanding that we fight for equality, but we also need to fight for equity, understanding not everyone starts out at the same place.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. Gosh, I saw some interviews of residents of a mobile home park that was leveled on Sanibel Island. But regardless, and I mean, they were white, so I mean, right. I know they're not of interest to Kamala. That's really what you want to do? That's what you want your first responders to do. That's how we want to think about rendering aid to those in need. We need to think first about race and then about need. Prioritize based on race, subordinating need. Well, Deanna Criswell, the FEMA administrator, she was on with Face the Nation. She was asked about Kamala's comments, and she said this.
I was on the ground Friday and Saturday. I was assessing the damage personally and talking to survivors. There are a lot of people that are going to need assistance as a result of this. And one of the things that I have known and I have experienced responding to other disasters, that there are people that often have a hard time accessing our programs. There's barriers to our program. And one of our focus areas since I've been in office is to make sure that we're removing those barriers. So these people that need our help the most are going to be able to access the help that we offer. I know that the vice president and the president, they share these same values. And again, I was on the ground Friday and Saturday, and I committed to the governor then that we are going to provide assistance to all Floridians.
Oh, there we go. We get back end after we do all the pro forma, share their values and blah, blah, blah. Okay. We're going to provide assistance of all Floridians. Well, we assume so, but is there going to be some sort of prioritization based on race?
Our programs support everybody. I would say I believe some of the things the vice president was talking about are the long-term recovery and rebuilding these communities to be able to withstand disasters so they can have less impact. We're going to support all communities. I committed that to the governor. I commit to you right here that all Floridians are going to be able to get the help that is available to them through our programs.
Yeah, it doesn't inspire a lot of confidence. No. Really mealy-mouthed.
And it should be according to greatest need, not race or anything else. And they know that. Greatest need. Forget about race. Forget about gender. Forget about if you're trans. Who cares? People are in need.
Seeking
and
out,
they alienated so many people by she did by making that comment.
Well, that's what she does. Seeking out communities of color. what does that even look like? It's just political cant. It's just a phrase that empty-headed automatons like Kamala Harris say. They don't know what that means. She's still trying to figure out if we have a relationship with North Korea or South Korea.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
You know, and particularly against the backdrop of the rising death toll, we know that 76 or 77 people.
No, it's 82 on the way in CBS's reporting.
Dozens 82. Of people have been killed. And you still have people that are dealing with the after effects. In Central Florida, you still have rising water levels. And you have the Vice President of the United States. I know it's incredible that she is, but she is trying to force this through a racial prism. Does it ever end with these people? And the answer is no, it doesn't.
And CNN, you know, they had a chance to interview Governor DeSantis live, you know, while he was out helping people in Lee County. And they're still trying to get the I gotcha moment with him.
It got hit with really biblical storm surge.
Well, that's not it. I don't know where my audio is, but he was being questioned. They're trying to say, why didn't you evacuate Lee County? And he said, people make their own decisions and we can't govern them and go into their houses and pull them out.
Cindy in Arlington Heights.
Hey, good morning, Dan. Hi, Amy. First of all, she's an idiot. And when people show you who they are, you got to pay attention to that. But I, for one, as old as I am, did not know that hurricanes could tell what race or ethnic background you are.
They target people of color.
Idiot.
Hurricanes target people of color.
And trailers. And just, she needs to just, like, go away fast as possible.
Thanks, Cindy. Rich, Indian Head Park.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. To take a disaster like this and to make it a racial issue is the most ridiculous thing I ever heard, especially from a vice president. She should be talking about how these people are going to be helped. It's not a matter of color. Everyone is affected by this. Have a good day.
Thanks for the call, Rich. Speaking of DeSantis, he also had a message, and you've seen a lot of this message you're about to hear echoed in no uncertain terms by residents through signs posted and whatnot. But a message to looters that rivaled old Mayor Daley's message to looters back in the rioting in the 60s.
The other thing that we're concerned about, particularly in those areas that were really hard hit, is, you know, we want to make sure we're maintaining law and order. Don't even think about looting. Don't even think about taking advantage of people in this vulnerable situation. And so local law enforcement is involved in monitoring that. You know, I told Kevin if the state needs to help as well, because, you can have people, you know, bringing boats into some of these islands and trying to ransack people's homes. I can tell you, in the state of Florida, you never know what may be lurking behind somebody's home. And I would not want to chance that if I were you, given that we're a Second Amendment state.
And Kevin's on the job, too, so you don't want to cross Kevin. That's state police, of course. My neighborhood down there, not far, just a little bit east of me.
Yeah, you tweeted out a picture of it.
Yeah, there's, you know, people put all the stuff that got destroyed on the curb to be picked up because they're doing, you know, pickups of all the property that's been destroyed, you know, the contents of houses. And somebody posted, positioned on plywood in the middle of the street, "You will be shot," which is just a little bit of neighborly advice, a reminder that looting will not be tolerated. So don't try to harvest other people's property in this emergency situation. And actually, in Fort Myers, we saw that some people that were attempting to loot were arrested. So, they're on the job there. It's a Second Amendment state. It's a law and order state. Gosh, I wonder what that's like. I wonder what that would be like to live in a Second Amendment state, a law and order state. Actually, you know, half of this state is such a state. South of I-80 is sort of a law and order, half a Second Amendment state. The northeastern Illinois, not so much. Michael on the south side.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. Thank you for taking my call. It wasn't just Kamala Harris politicizing the hurricane. I saw Jonathan Carl this week with George Stephanopoulos yesterday, and my jaw dropped because he was such a jerk while he was trying to politicize the hurricane. he interviewed the FEMA official, and naturally he had to talk about Lee County, which of course was Republican, and he asked about the issue of Lee County possibly delaying an evacuation. And then he turned on Marco Rubio, and he kept pounding Rubio on the issue of his vote regarding the assistance for Hurricane Sandy victims over and over, trying to bait Marco Rubio over the fact that he allegedly opposed funding for Hurricane Sandy victims, but is now asking for help for Florida. Just disgusting.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Michael. Appreciate it. Philip in Blue Island.
I heard a minute ago a mistake that was made about a storm of biblical proportion. And then I sit back and think of DeSantis sending people, whatever you want to call them, immigrants, whatever you want to call them, all over to all these different states. And then all of a sudden a storm of biblical proportion hits Florida because of some of the things that how he was treating the poor. And then Kamala Harris saying that the poor... That those who are poor should get the most immediate help.
That's not what you said.
Philip, he was talking about Sanibel Island. What hit Sanibel Island was biblical.
Well, first of all, are you suggesting that the Hurricane Ian hitting Florida was karmic? That was in response to DeSantis sending migrants to Martha's Vineyard? Is that what you're saying?
And that and other things.
Okay. And then I just want to be clear. And then the second thing is you need to get some Q-tips out. Clean out your ears. Because Kamala Harris didn't say poor. She said people of color. It was not a economic prism. It was a racial prism that she offered.
Well,
No, not well. That's what she did. Thanks for the call, Philip. Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Let's do a little Safety Act update since the hot topic in the candidate forum between Pritzker and Bailey on Friday, which we'll get to. Individual charged with the attack of that older gentleman on the red line where he hit him in the head with the bottle, from inside the gentleman's coat. And then he robbed somebody else on the CTA the next day.
Yeah, because, you know, they never stop. They're very well known to Chicago police, Chicago Heights police, and Glenwood police.
Been denied bail.
Oh, really?
He's being charged with two counts of robbery, charges of theft, and aggravated battery. So understand something. The only reason he's being held without bail is because the Pritzker purge law is not in effect until Jan 1. Well, there's two reasons. That's one. And the second is because we're 5 weeks from an election, and that's a high-profile attack.
Well, because the video was everywhere, thanks to your campaign ad, and that regular all the TV stations covered it, too.
But understand something.
Because he was caught on tape, and the world saw that's a graphic reminder of living in Chicago.
Aggravated battery, theft, robbery. He's out. He walks under Pritzker's purge law, the so-called Safety Act. He walks. No, he doesn't. No. There's still an opportunity for blah, blah. You don't know what you're talking about. You're not listening to prosecutors. You're just repeating pat lines from political hacks like Jelly Belly or the never convicted domestic abuser who's the Speaker of the House. Okay? So if you hear this from these dum-dums in your social circles, then set them straight. Because it's time for some of the woke to awaken. If you want to live in a safe, literally, now we're really talking about public safety, not your phony baloney safe spaces, literally talking about public safety here, your personal safety. That's on the ballot. Civilization on the ballot, November 8th. Oh, and again, that's not me saying it. That's actually listening to people who are telling you what the impact will be on the jobs they do in the personal safety space, like police, prosecutors, judges, sheriffs. Tom Weitzel was a former police chief for Riverside. He writes in the AFL-CIO NPR Times, "I'm a former police chief. Here's what's wrong with the Safety Act." And to my point and his about instances like this red line attack, one major reform, and he uses that term generously, is that all defendants shall be presumed eligible for pretrial release. Shall be presumed eligible for pretrial release. This puts the burden on the state to prove by, quote, clear and convincing evidence, that's the standard, that the defendant has committed offense and poses a real and present threat to public safety and a specific real and present threat, like to a specific individual, as we've discussed before. A second provision requires, this is Weitzel, former police chief, Riverside, writing, second provision requires suspects must show evidence of willful flight, which means planning or attempting to evade prosecution by concealing oneself to be considered a flight risk. So you can't look at the guy, and I mean, in terms of his behavior, what he's done, and also take into account prior bad acts and say, you know, this is a guy that could run on us and let's hold him over for trial. Evidence that he is planning or attempting to evade prosecution, planning an escape, planning to flee, or he writes, in the past, failure to show up for a court appearance was evidence of evasion. But now, judges will not be allowed to take into consideration whether a suspect jumped bail, how many times the suspect failed to show in court, and if there's an active warrant for their arrest. So you can't use evidence of not showing up for a court date previously to suggest this guy may not show up for the next court date if we don't hold him over for trial. This is the inanity we're dealing with. And the propagandizing by Jelly Belly and the Chicago Press Corps that serves as his comm shop is just as preposterous.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Then on the flight issue, more on the flight issue. Defendants who are on electronic monitoring not considered as having escaped until they've been missing for more than 48 hours. This is Tom Weitzel writing.
Okay.
This rule is just nothing short of ludicrous and in no way, shape, or form enhances public safety. Obviously. A 48-hour free pass before a judge can issue a warrant for their arrest? 48-hour head start?
You could go places in 48 hours.
Is that not stupefying on its face? Does this need to be explained? Apparently, to the General Assembly, it does. He makes another point, too, a practical one. Because, you know, I know that people have these theories about how the world is supposed to work in their mind. And then, you know, it meets the reality of how things work in practice. The law also puts a tremendous administrative burden on the average police officer in the arrest and booking process. There are now four additional forms for the process, and the flow charts are complicated, time-consuming, and do not serve public safety. What does it really mean? The average police officer on a felony arrest responds to the scene, arrests the individual, transports them to the police facility, contacts the state's attorney felony review unit for charges, books the prisoner, gets them to felony bond court. Now an officer will be required to be in the station doing paperwork, making sure to follow these flow charts, which are all public, pretrial implementation task force. You can go look at the flow charts yourselves. And meeting every single aspect of this burdensome requirement. The police officer who should be patrolling your community will be on the street less, in most cases far less. You could have officers doing paperwork for 6 to 8 hours on a single arrest, which is unacceptable. And the practical consequences of those practical consequences? The law will create apathy and low morale. Officers may think, why bother charging someone with this felony and going through the felony review? Through a felony review when they're just going to be released without bond anyway. In many cases, this will be true. I'm not saying it's right, writes Weitzel, nor am I advocating for it. I'm only telling the public what will happen. Officers simply will not file felony charges when they believe offenders will not be held accountable or have bond assigned to them in court. One can debate the merits on that, but it will happen unless there is some modification in the Safety Act. That's just what's going to happen. So, you know, again, I know that's an unacceptable truth. There are acceptable lies told by Governor Spaulding and the assembled power structure in this state, supported by the comm shop, all the nonprofits, and the Chicago Press Corps, which serve as sort of campaign appendages for these people. Acceptable lies. They're allowed to tell you acceptable lies, like this will make Illinois safer. This is going to keep people accused of violent crimes behind bars.
Rich people behind bars.
How does that make... I mean, can people follow the logic? This, I want to pull my hair out. We're going to release people, and that's going to keep them behind bars. What?
And then I don't know if you saw this tweet from CWB. It was over the weekend. People would be shocked if they knew how many people charged with criminal sexual assault, rape, are on bail, often without electronic monitoring, alleged serial rapists even. If judges don't think they're a threat to the community now, why would they after January 1st? And I want to know the number. I would love to know how many people, alleged rapists, some even serial rapists, are out and they're not even on electronic monitoring, awaiting trial.
Over the weekend, CWB Chicago documented number 43.
A high school senior, by the way.
Number 43 is a 17-year-old who sped away from Chicago police in a hijacked SUV, then slammed into the car of Dominga Flores, killing her. That individual was awaiting trial for a felony gun case when he killed Dominga Flores.
Yeah, but he had passengers in his car. He had a 15-year-old, and he had another juvenile who was charged with having, who had three active warrants on him and a felony gun case.
One of his passengers was on parole, on bail for a felony gun case, had three active warrants. His other two passengers are charged with having guns in the SUV that they crashed when the driver killed Dominga Flores. He is the 43rd person accused of killing or shooting or attempting to kill or shoot someone in Chicago while awaiting trial for a felony just this year. Those alleged crimes involve at least 80 victims, 19 of whom are dead.
And the dead is 55-year-old Dominga Flores, who is a mother and very loved in her community. And that 17-year-old scumbag, the senior in high school, who he took off his ski mask, Dan, after the crash and ran from the scene. His attorney said that he's been participating in a mentoring program for 2 years at his high school.
Honor student.
Mentor.
Turning his life around.
He's a mentor.
Is Dominga Flores, that sounds like a person of color.
Yeah, she is.
So is that what Dem socialist power structure is doing, looking out for people of color who are overwhelmingly the victims of the lawlessness that they have unleashed on the city, on the county, and aim to do on the state? Is that what's happening?
We had a 7-year-old shot, too.
7-year-old shot
on
in Mosler,
the way to church.
A 3-year-old killed in Westlawn, a 14-year-old shot in Chatham. That's just this weekend.
300 kids have been shot so far. And the 7-year-old, he was on his way to church with his family, and they were driving by, and they saw the guy busting into their other car that they own, and they said, hey, stop it, and then he returned fire and just sprayed their car with bullets. He's going to live, but it's just... It's a war zone. He was going to church sunny day on a Sunday.
Roger, Southside. Hey, Roger.
When are people going to start calling out that this is just all Tony Preckwinkle's Marxist fantasy? I mean, here, I think even some of the Black Caucus now are can't keep a straight face. You know, with all the challenges that are coming on with the Safety Act.
Well, they're doing a pretty good job. LG Sims and some of the other ones are doing. Cam Buckner. I see a lot of Black legislators doing a pretty good job of keeping a straight face and spewing the same propaganda as Pritzker.
Well, they're clowns. They're complete clowns.
Well, I know.
I mean,
here's
the problem we have. Here's the problem. You know, is that most of our General Assembly. Okay, in the Democratic side, is not even one generation from drug or gang culture, active members of their family. Okay, and whatever they call them, is allowed these people to do it. So, you'll back me? Okay, fine. I think he's going to have a little problem, though. I think Bailey's going to come strong, and if Tony doesn't steal Cook County at the Board of Elections, which most elections are stolen at, I think we could get him out of there. But, I mean, the real problem here is Preckwinkle. Not Fox, not Lightfoot. I mean, Lightfoot, Jesus, would you trust her to get you a coffee order right? Yeah. Honestly.
Thanks for the call, Roger. I mean, we don't include Preckwinkle enough, so I take your point on that. It's all of them. I understand that Kim Fox is a Preckwinkle protege. But, I mean, that, you know, so it's Preckwinkle, it's Fox, it's Lightfoot, it's Evans, it's Pritzker, it's Harmon, Senate President, it's Welch, the Speaker of the House. It's the power structure. The entire Dem Socialist power structure. Tony Roselle.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. The driver who killed that woman down by the jail, he was mentoring youth. He was mentoring his fellow criminals in his College of Criminal Behavior.
Thanks for the call, Tony. Molly Deerfield.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. You know, I live up in Lake County, and I received a Lake County Gazette. And I was flipping through it, and I saw that all these representatives that voted yes for the Safety Act, Julie Morrison being one.
Of course.
And her office is up in Highwood. So I actually took the paper into her office the other day. I happened to be up there. And she was right in the office. The door was open. And I very politely said, Ms. Morrison, my name is Molly. I introduced myself. And I said, I'm wondering why you voted. I'd like to know why you voted yes for the Safety Act. And she said, that's a Republican rag. And I said, but you're in here saying that you voted for it. Did you or did you not vote? Yes. And she stepped back and she said, well, I did. I did. Yeah. However.
So it wasn't. It wasn't about a lie. Interesting.
Yeah. Right. So she said, this is about if I commit a crime and a person of color. So she went into that spiel, how there's not equity. But then she backpedaled and she said, I will admit that I did. It stinks that it passed at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I didn't know everything that was in the bill when I voted. And I said, well, you know what?
She's a gift.
Shame
Julie
on
Morrison.
You for that. Yeah. And then I said, so then she said to me, she goes, you're not the only one who's upset about this. And then she admits that she's, you know, she's against the trespassing part of this whole thing, whether that's going to be gone. And then she said, she said, I will vote for reform.
Yeah, of course she will. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks so much,
yeah,
Molly.
Good job.
Great story. Thanks for the call. Mm-hmm. Julie Morrison is one of the dumber legislators. And that's really, I mean, that really is saying something. And she just can't help herself. Like they most of them. So now the position as they're backpedaling is say, well, you know, I think there's some reasonable. You heard it from Jelly Belly on Mike Scott's newscast. Oh, you know, there's some language cleanup we could do so that people who are confused about what the Safety Act does won't be confused anymore. Oh, good. I'm sure Jim Glasgow and the other 99 county prosecutors will be happy to learn that their confusion about what the law does will be alleviated when Jelly Belly and the lawyers, the corp counsel's office there get to cleaning up that language, because that's really all we're talking about is, you know, there's some tense issues in the language and so on. I mean, are you kidding?
Yeah, but Cam Buckner and the House Speaker, they don't want anything changed at all.
Julie Morrison is up there in that communist enclave in the North Shore. I mean, if she's feeling the pressure, that should tell you something. And she clearly is, based on that conversation that Molly from Deerfield had with her. She should be. Everybody. Well, this is the whole thing. It's a Republican. And that's what I love her response, too. Of course, that's a response. Oh, that's a Republican propaganda. Is it wrong? No. But let me explain to you. Okay. Right. So, again, acceptable lies. That is what the left and Jelly Belly promulgate. And then unacceptable truths. The contents of the newspapers, my ads, and so forth. Unacceptable. So you just get to dismiss them categorically because you can't address anything specifically. And when you're challenged, as Molly challenged Julie, oh, well, yeah, I did, and it's true. But, you know, let me explain. Oh, okay, please, explain. The floor is yours. Susan, Southside. Hi, Susan.
Susan, are you there? Hello.
Yes, hi, I'm here. You know what, I'm a former employee of the Cook County State's Attorney's Office. I left not too long ago, and I was actually in the sex crimes unit. And this is to Amy's point, going to the sex offenders that are on bond. And I can tell you for a fact that a large percentage of my cases, which were offenders charged with criminal or predatory criminal sexual assault, which is the pedophile charges where they're abusing young children, many of them were on bond or EM. So they were walking around. The judges didn't think they were a threat to society at large, and they were walking around on EM. So well, I just wanted to make that point.
I appreciate that. I mean, we saw this last week with the guy who attempted to kidnap that woman in West Loop.
Right.
He was released and for not filing as a sex offender, right? And this is,
yeah, absolutely.
This is where it is. Okay. All right. Thanks for the call, Susan.
He wasn't even on EM, electronic monitoring. They just let him out. I mean, and he'd already attacked another woman prior to that. I mean, what the hell is going on here?
Well, I don't know.
I'm scared.
I don't know. But
I don't like living scared.
But you know, the people who are willing to confront the truth must confront people who are willing to settle for acceptable lies. I know that. And you got 5 weeks.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Not nearly enough people are stepping up and speaking out, but a lot are. Starting with Jim Glasgow, we were talking about Pritzker's Purge Law before Mike Scott's newscast, revisiting that now that it was a topic of discussion in the first candidate forum between Bailey and Pritzker on Friday.
Did anybody watch it?
The story, the Purge Law, continues to make national and international news.
As it should.
Breitbart picked it up. You've heard on this show, Greg Gutfeld has talked about it in his show. Joe Rogan talked about it on his podcast. It's still making the rounds because people are incredulous that this is actually real, and it is real. I think there's a lot of Illinoisans who still are incredulous that it's real, still skeptical that it's real. It's real.
And the kids are hearing about it via Snapchat and TikTok, and so they're talking about it.
Johnson County Sheriff, that's Southern Illinois, Peter Sopcich. Anyone sitting in jail right now with all these pending charges are going to be let out. The gates are open, and they're going to be let out on the streets. Jim Glasgow recently, it will destroy the state of Illinois. Jay Hanley, Winnebago County State's Attorney. Imagine the defendant who murdered his wife, to whom he no longer poses a threat, being released because of this ridiculously limited legal standard. You're released unless you can prove the defendant poses a threat to a specific person. Mm-hmm. And we know what the experience is in New York with some of the initial data. And that their law doesn't go nearly as far as Illinois's. And the results, the net result is more crime. More crime by people who were released had they not been released than had they not been released. So it's like we're talking about with the 43 so far this year and the 75 last year. People that attempted to kill or killed somebody while awaiting trial for attempting to kill or killing somebody. And are on electronic monitoring. That's just remarkable. It's just remarkable. And I think it should be the referendum question, effectively the referendum question on the November 8th ballot. I really do. Because if you don't have personal security, you don't have much. And you don't have civilization.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You can also reach us on our text line. 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
So Pritzker and Bailey square off on this issue in the candidate forum. That was a Zoom candidate forum. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's not a real debate format like most of these non-debate debates. But they both had a chance to characterize each other as it pertains to the Purge Law. First, Pritzker.
Darren Bailey wants to keep the current system where murderers and rapists and domestic abusers can buy their way out of jail.
Mm-hmm. Bailey's retort.
Sometimes I can't figure out if our governor's a fool or a liar, but he's trying to dupe us, and that's exactly what's taking place. He intends to let criminals out of jail.
I mean, again, I can't believe this is in controversy for some people. Forget, you know, I'm not a Republican. Okay, fine. 100 of 102 state's attorneys, including 24 Democrat state's attorneys. You're hearing from police chiefs and sheriffs and other. They're not necessarily affiliated with the Republican Party at all. Not supporting Bailey at all. What do you think? You think they're just authoritarians who want to lock everybody up and throw away the key? Is that what you think of your local prosecutor? Your local police? I just don't understand. I mean, I really struggle to understand the disconnect or the willful blindness. Because at this point, with as much attention as this has gotten, it really is bordering on willful blindness if you don't understand what's happening or you're at least not aware of it and trying to process it. And here's what you're up against. Here's what you're up against. You're up against the combine of the power structure in these big cities and blue states, the political power structure, which includes the entire press corps. Larry Krasner is a Soros-funded DA in Philadelphia who got reelected just like Kim Fox. Cultural suicide, civilizational suicide. It's just that these big cities. What, how much worse does it have to get? As somebody is asking. No, oh, that would be me.
Yeah. Well, what
commercial after commercial?
Yeah.
So Krasner was asked about violent crime in Philadelphia and his approach to violent crime, which essentially mirrors Kim Fox's approach. So you know what that looks like. And Mike Jarek, who's the one of the morning anchors there on Good Morning Philadelphia, or whatever the hell it's called. He used to be a host on Fox and Friends back in the day.
Oh, that's right.
He tries to press him. But listen to what Larry Krasner says that is demonstrably false. But it doesn't matter.
Until we had reform prosecutors where people tried to blame just one entity, we all have to work together. And the reality is that we have been more effective.
And you are a reform district attorney. Everybody in the country knows that. But maybe it's not working.
It is working. The reality is that our
1,000 people killed in 20 months.
It is working. The reality is when you look at all these different jurisdictions, we have had a devastating blow from the pandemic. And there is absolutely no correlation between being progressive or traditional and the rate of crime. These states in the United States that have a rate of homicide that is 40% higher are MAGA states. They are Trump states. I'll say it again. The rate of homicide in Trump states as compared to Biden states, take all 50 of them, is 40% higher.
You know, Republicans say the opposite. It's all the blue states.
Republicans lie. I mean, let's just get down to it. Republicans lie. That is what they do. Eight of the 10 cities without, not, well, okay, that's right. Not all of them do, but the MAGA ones do. Eight out of 10 of the most violent cities are Trump cities. Like, we got to get real about this. Facts matter. Law matters.
The perception about you is there. I still say the perception is there. Right or wrong, D.A. Krasner, maybe for a fresh start, resign. That doesn't even cross your mind, does it?
No, because the fact is Philadelphia voted for me overwhelmingly because they want what we are doing.
And the general was a right
change. Excuse me, may I finish? When you bring change, the reality is that there are certain entities who don't want change. They're making a pretty good living off of doing things the old way. The NRA doesn't like me because I speak the truth about the NRA. Our governor has tried his entire term to pass four different things to bring gun safety. The Republicans won't do it.
The homicide rate 40% higher in MAGA states. 8 of the 10 cities with the highest murder rate are Trump cities. Okay, well, here's the data. I wish Mike Jarek would have made him tick off those cities and provide an explication of whatever data he's referring to. But here's the data. This is through June of last year. This was reported in February. The highest murder per capita rates by city in the country. Number one, New Orleans.
Democrat. Okay.
Right. Louisiana. I mean, Louisiana has a Democrat governor. I guess you could say Trump won it. But I mean, right.
And New Orleans itself has a
crazy
Democratic mayor.
But law enforcement is primarily a local matter, as we know. Baltimore is number two.
All right.
That's a Dem
completely
city
Dem.
And a Dem state.
All right. Well,
Birmingham, Alabama is number three. The mayor of Birmingham is a Dem. Alabama is a red state, but Birmingham. St. Louis's mayor is a Dem.
Yep.
Missouri's a red state, but again, Milwaukee.
That's a Democratic mayor, but.
And Democrat governor at present.
And the state is, right.
Cleveland, Democrat mayor, Republican governor. Rochester, New York, Dem. Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Dem. Atlanta, Dem mayor, Republican governor.
Went for
Biden, as we famously know. Kansas City, Missouri, Dem
mayor.
Dem mayor. Washington, D.C., Dem mayor. Richmond, Virginia, Dem mayor, Republican governor recently. But Oakland, California, Dem. Cincinnati, Dem. Chicago, you may have heard, Democrat mayor, Democrat governor. I mean, what the hell is he talking about? But it just doesn't matter. The more outlandish the statement, the more it will get rinsed and repeated by the left and amplified by their allies, well, de facto employees in the press corps. I mean, you can't. One day I'm going to explain just how difficult it is even to air a message that deviates from what a properly housebroken Republican is allowed to say in a place like Chicago, dealing as I do every single day with all of these networks. You have no idea. People have no idea how in the tank the press corps is for the acceptable lies told by the left, and how many barriers they put up to unacceptable truths, to the truth being told, because it's unacceptable, because it jeopardizes their political standing, which is why you can have the entire Chicago press corps and Springfield political press corps. You can have all the cultural and civic institutions at your beck and call, which Pritzker does. And somebody puts out a newspaper with unacceptable truths, and it's, batten down the hatches, all hands on deck, got to torpedo those newspapers. Call the printer. Tell them they can't print it. Tell the news stations. Get a commercial up. Blah, blah, blah. Lie, 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 lie. Pink slime, pink slime, pink slime. Right-wing extremists, right-wing extremists, right-wing extremists. And at least, we'll see. And half the state, hopefully it's just slightly less than half the state, has that hook in their mouth. And they just need Pritzker to yank it. Sandra in Rogers Park.
Good morning. 2 weeks ago, my car was stolen. It was a dumb mistake on my part, but everything was in my car. And the guy had three felonies. He was out on three felonies. And so when they caught him with my car 5 days later, the judge decided to keep him in jail. This would be his fourth felony. And there wouldn't have been a second or a third or a fourth, person suffering from this guy if he'd just been jailed for the first felony.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for the call, Sandra. Sorry that happened to you. Oh, something else, too, how they talk about crime. Because they're so compassionate. They're so concerned about victims of crime.
I don't care about the victims.
Oh, my God.
About the suspects.
Did you check with the victim before you aired the footage that we aired on our newscast? Oh, heavens.
They never check with the victims, and they've been running that since the beginning of time. If it bleeds, it leads.
You traumatize them all over again. Here's an example of how they actually think. This was accidentally said out loud. Defund the police, Dem Socialist City Councilwoman in New York, Tiffany Caban, tweeted out, "Subway violence is a one-in-a-million event. Let's not let fear-mongering politicians and corporate media scare us into thinking we have a dangerous, scary public transit system."
Oh, are you kidding me?
Right. And then she's getting response from, you know, people who've been beaten on the subway in New York.
Yeah. Well, that one guy who killed his grandmother, his foster grandmother, he was out and he beat up a woman for no reason because she looked at him the wrong way.
More just made up numbers, too, like Larry Krasner does. One in a million event. It's literally not a one in a million event.
No.
And it's becoming more and more likely, even though, you know, the percentages are small. But, you know, it's like a murder rate of 37 in 1,000 in New Orleans. You know, those killings and other violent crime, they reverberate throughout a neighborhood. I mean, first of all, throughout a family, and then throughout a neighborhood and a community. You can't look at these things in a silo, of course, but that's how the politicians look at them. You're just a statistic. Corey Woodlawn.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. You know, I wanted to comment about the previous segment, but I do want to comment about this crime. If you go on heyjackass.com, you see the first six communities in Chicago has more murders than the whole entire city of Baltimore. And that's scary. And so when this guy gets out there, Mr. Crass, and starts lying, anyone can look this data up. And another startling statistic is this. Every time around elections, you see this crime start to uptick. So what is the media out there telling these individuals where crime starts to push its way up? Thank you.
Thanks, Corey. Carl, Marionette Park.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. Thank you for taking my call. I'm sorry if you hear humming noise. I'm on oxygen around the clock. I was telling your call screener about a story I read on the iPad. It was a week ago yesterday, and believe it or not, it came from ABC7 in Chicago, and it was about a woman in Van Nuys, California, and homeless people and people out of prison were sleeping on her porch. She called the police. All the police could do was come to remove them. A couple of hours later, they returned again, and she called, and again, they came and removed them. Then she came, they were up there again, destroying her home with graffiti. They're trying to break in, and she's in tears, and she was saying she's afraid she's going to have to do something to save her life. And where she's coming from, she might have to shoot them, then she's going to jail for trying to protect her life and property. Well, you people in Illinois better wake up. We don't need Pritzker for governor, because if you vote for him, who knows, you could be one of the victims, or somebody from your family one of the victims. Thank you for taking my call, Dan.
Thanks, Carl. Clay Wheeling.
Good morning, Amy. I think the absolute worst part about this whole purge thing is we're never going to learn from it. It's going to be a year down the line, and we're going to have a crime skyrocket up 60-70%, and we're going to do nothing about it. Maybe pass a few more laws and raise a few more taxes, but we'll learn nothing about it. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Clay. Dave Cicero.
Yes, sir. On Saturday, talked to a long-term buddy of mine. He's a just retired Chicago black cop, 55 years old. Needless to say, I won't say his name. I'll just call him John. That's not his real name. So he got a nice family, built a beautiful house on the west side, remodeled the house over decades. He says, now this guy, he looks like he could be in that MMA. Built, he's strong. This looks like a guy you do not want to mess with.
Mm-hmm.
230 pounds solid muscle. He says that he doesn't go out at night. Him and his wife and his kids. He's on his kids. His college age kids don't go out at night. When he goes out socially with his other cop friends, you know, retired cop friends, buddies, they go out in groups. They park together. They leave the restaurant together. They stay in groups. His wife is a concealed carry to protect herself. He goes, I don't go out as much as possible. I don't go out alone. He doesn't go jogging in his neighborhood. This guy looks like he could be NFL. I go, with your look, you're telling me you have to be like that? He goes, yeah. He goes, that's how it is. He goes, it's changed. He goes, it's worse. It's very, very dangerous. Don't shoot the reporter. I'm just saying what this guy told me Saturday.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for the call. And right, it's like the CPS teacher who sends their kid to a private school. Golly, what do they know? What do they know about where they work? So what does he know about the city in which he works? And is that the way you want? And he's hardly alone with that feeling. He's just been, I'm sure, I can't even imagine the things that he's seen over his time on the force. But the point is that how you want to live as a prisoner in your own city? Or you want to roll the dice and with your head in the clouds?
You want more than just the headlines? Find out what's going on and what it means with me, Dennis Prager, this morning at 11, right here on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Life in America, American culture, literally a Monty Python skit now. Let me give you an example of what I mean. This is from Life of Brian in 1979. 1979. So what is that? 43 years ago?
You do the math. It's Monday.
Okay.
Why are you always on about women, Stan?
I want to be one.
What?
I want to be a woman. From now on, I want you all to call me Loretta.
What?
It's my right as a man.
Well, why do you want to be Loretta, Stan?
I want to have babies.
You want to have babies?
It's every man's right to have babies if he wants them.
But you can't have babies!
Don't you oppress me.
I'm not oppressing you, Stan. You haven't got a womb. Where's the fetus going to gestate? You're going to keep it in a box?
Here, I've got an idea. Suppose you agree that he can't actually have babies, not having a womb, which is nobody's fault, not even the Romans, but that he can have the right to have babies.
Good idea, Judith. We shall fight the oppressors for your right to have babies, brother. Sister, sorry. What's the point?
What?
What's the point of fighting for his right to have babies when he can't have babies? It is symbolic of our struggle against oppression.
Symbolic of his struggle against reality.
And now today, fast forward, here's a bearded chick on TikTok telling women who are uncomfortable with his presence in their bathroom they're misogynists.
If this is like a physical space, I'm always going to prioritize my own safety because oftentimes that discomfort somebody feels is actually just violence waiting to happen. And it's also not my job as the trans person to navigate the discomfort. I'm not the one who's uncomfortable with other women. They are. I'm just existing. And so my question is, if you're uncomfortable, why are you uncomfortable with other women? What pieces of internalized misogyny are failing you right now? What is in your way of acknowledging this person's or my humanity? Those are often not things that people can answer right off the bat, but they're really the important underlying questions to be asking ourselves. Sometimes right off the bat, though, I can sense it. I'm like, oh, okay, I've seen this before. I know how this goes. And I give them a compliment. It's really hard to dislike somebody when they're nice to you first. It also helps me humanize that person sometimes and go, you know what? There was a time when I had some unlearning to do and they're at that place in their journey. But it's tricky because often they're just uncomfortable and I'm unsafe.
Sometimes what gets in the way of the internalized misogyny is your penis, sir. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I wonder, I don't know who that person is, the bearded chick. I know who the Monty Python cast is. But I'm going to hazard a guess that he has an advanced degree from some elite private institution. I'm just going to guess. And it would be in something like gender studies, I suspect. For more on the culture on college campus these days, as the purge continues, Sam Abrams joins us. He's a professor of politics at Sarah Lawrence College, the alma mater of one tiny dancer, Chicago's very own, and senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Sam Abrams, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you. You made me laugh with the tiny dancer comment.
Yeah, well, you know.
Oh, that's his moniker.
That's what I, yeah. What I do. Yeah, I've popularized. Yes.
He's in Japan now, but he's still dance, tiny dance.
He's still small.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's no question about that. I noticed, just in terms of that little cultural example I offered, and the mention of the purge, when I was saying the purge continues, I'm thinking of Jonathan Haidt, a guy, you know, man of the left, mugged by the reality of the left on college campuses. Last week, this high-profile psych professor announced that at the end of this year, he's resigning from the Society for Personality and Social Psychology, his primary professional association, because of the newly adopted requirement that everybody presenting research at the group's conferences explain how their submission advances DEI and anti-racism goals. That's where it's at. Yeah?
Yes. So the thing to think about there is that I wrote a big follow-up in another site called Minding the Campus of this. John is absolutely right. These requirements and expectations are a disaster. They basically shut down scientific inquiry. Rather than saying, here's the question, here's what I'd like to do, we have to infuse the political ideology with it. In John's case, he'll be okay. He's a senior guy. He's tenured. He's at NYU. He's fine.
Right.
The thing that's really scary to me here is that there are many faculty who cannot resign. This is how they get ahead. This is how they publish. This is how they network. These are credential and legitimacy-granting organizations in many spheres that they need to be part of. So this is a very scary move. And it's not just in his organization. We see this across the board in professional organizations and on college and university life generally. Diversity statements are multiplying. We are expected to explain why certain things promote diversity. And that in and of itself is not an awful goal. But when it impedes and interrupts scientific discovery and politicizes discovery and the process, it's really, really dangerous and really very scary.
Well, and so the solution or the response needs to be more heterodox academies like Height founded or co-founded, along with efforts underway like University of Austin, or what are we to do as higher ed continues to get underwritten by the federal government to make the same choices they've been making and to keep the same people employed,
of course.
While it's just becoming an incubator of Marxism and Marxists.
Right. So first of all, the federal government needs to condition its money on non-ideological research. The minute you throw the ideology in, it needs to stop, and the government should not support it. That's going to be very hard to do under the Biden administration. It was certainly something that the earlier administration under Trump was trying to do, and we certainly saw that in the Department of Education and demanded more transparency, less ideology, and more clarity. That's part one. We also need other tenured faculty members, like myself, to not just tweet, we stand with Height or we stand with these views. We actually need to do something about it. We need to get on, you know, various committees, if those even matter. We need to say we're not doing this. We may all need to resign en masse. We may need to reject the system entirely. This is something that may not happen. I'm not particularly optimistic about it, but the faculty need to push back. This is a dire threat to the very process of innovation and discovery. We can't politicize science to this degree. It's dangerous. It's reductionist, and it doesn't lead necessarily to the best outcomes. It shouldn't be about who's conducting the science, although we should try to make it inclusive. It should be what is the science, period.
It seems to me,
and that's a good thing.
It seems to me too. You have to, you know, go where the money is. So that's to the donors, and it seems to me a lot of these professors who serve as the chairman of this endowed chair by this foundation or this rich individual, they need to be going to their sponsors and saying, you know, you got to turn the screws here. The funding from foundations, the funding from high net worth individuals needs to be challenged. And it can't just be among the professor talking to themselves. They should be reaching out to those who they have relationships with, who have, you know, the power of the purse.
Well, you know, it's very clear based on literally 5 years of research that so many people think this is disgusting, whether it's small donors, larger donors, and quite a few foundations. There are some foundations, like the Ford Foundation, which have been really stoking fire here. They've been throwing a lot of money at DEI, but what we're now saying in liberal arts college, JEDI, Justice, Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion. So it's not just DEI, we add the J to it.
Oh, great.
You know, this has become very dangerous, but there are huge numbers of foundations. And again, most Americans, when they are introduced to this, they see it, they think it's disgusting. It's actually similar to the leading quotes, right? It's about oppression. You know, the other thing we need to push back on is this concept of oppression. You know, don't bring students into a collegiate environment and say that they're oppressed. The minute they land on campus, they're told, you're oppressed for a whole host of issues. That makes it very hard to work past these issues, accept difference, work through difference, and actually create community. It's dangerous as can be.
Well, let's talk about that NBC poll that was released in August that only 20% of college sophomores surveyed said they can definitely see themselves rooming with someone who voted differently than they did in the 2020 presidential election. What does that say about our society?
That says that they are being, in my view, brainwashed. It's saying that these students are being told you can't work or disagree healthily. You know, there's this big push of late to say, look, everyone needs to come together and agree on everything. That's not necessarily going to happen, and that's okay. People can come from principled difference. The issue is not vilifying, ostracizing, and trying to basically say the other is awful. I mean, you know, the second lead-in, I mean, you heard that. I mean, that was very, very disturbing, because rather than accept difference, the idea that the person is evil, the person is wrong, the person is problematic, if you disagree with that person's statement about battles and identity, that's very, very scary. That leads to radicalism, because instead of accepting that difference and saying, all right, you go ahead and do your thing, we're going to do ours, you know, it creates an us versus them, an in-group, out-group bias. And that can lead to violence. That is what's leading to violence. That's leading to the seething anger that we have. And this logic of oppression, this logic of victimhood, this logic of difference that is seething in thanks to our administrative class, which, by the way, outnumbers faculty on college and university campuses today, is just the hotbed for this. What's even scarier now is that these students who have been taught this over the last decade have left. So they're in the workforce, and they're demanding this in tech firms, law firms, financial services firms, they're demanding it everywhere. So this, you know, this has certainly crossed the gates of our leafy campuses, and pushback needs to happen. Americans very clearly, we've done many surveys on this, dislike this. They think this is dangerous. They think this is really antithetical. It's time for Americans to speak out.
Yeah, and no, you're right, too, about the administrative overhead of college campuses. They spend less on classroom instruction than Chicago Public Schools do, like 30%. I mean, it's a joke, and of course nobody knows this.
And even in my own institution, we're sent emails. Oh, we just had this new dean or this new dean or that new dean.
Yeah.
And I assure you, these deans make considerably more than me and the other faculty who are doing the teaching day in and day out.
Well, something else, too, beyond like, you know, worrying about the gender studies major going out into the world. I worry about medical professionals going out to the world and the degeneration of institutions that will continue because they're political organizations, not professional organizations, and they don't deliver what they promised to deliver. The quality gets diluted. So let me give you an example. University of Minnesota Medical School, the class of 2026, recited an oath during their white coat ceremony that went something like this. Our institution is located on Dakota land. We commit to uprooting the legacy and perpetuation of structural violence deeply embedded within the healthcare system. We recognize the inequities built by past and present traumas rooted in white supremacy, colonialism, the gender binary, ableism, and all other forms of oppression.
Yep.
Uh-huh. And the media relations manager at the med school explains that each year, the University of Minnesota Medical School, the incoming students work with faculty to write an oath that reflects the core elements, values, and ethics the class aspires to uphold. Well, if that's the future of the medical profession, then we're in trouble.
Yes, and that's not an outlier. It's everywhere. It's everywhere. And it's in professional society outside of just the training. You know, we don't have great data on medical doctors and attitudes toward those. But, you know, when I speak with medical physicians all the time about this, and I am receiving many, many inbounds from many physicians about these sorts of things, it appears as if there is incredible disdain. Now it's a question of organizing. You know, on the left, this stuff did not happen overnight. This stuff percolated for decades in the academy and then eventually developed into these movements. But it happened over the course of 20 to 30 years. The pushback has to be swifter than that. I think it'll be there because I don't think there's a question of, is this oppressive language or language of oppression, rather, appropriate? It isn't. It's wrong. It's scary. It's damaging the medical profession. It's going to diminish care. It's not about, you know, what land you're on. If someone needs help, help them, period. And let's get the best people in who can do that, the best trained, the smartest, the most able. But again, you're absolutely right. It becomes a political body rather than a healthcare or a service body, and that's incredibly scary, incredibly dangerous. It's pushback. There are a number of very high-profile physicians pushing back on this, and it's just going to take time. I wish it didn't because it's pretty scary, but it's going to take time, and I think we'll get there.
Something else too. This is sort of remarkable to me because there's a lot of people that are Jewish who are in academia, Also in the legal profession, University of California, Berkeley School of Law amended their bylaws to ensure nobody who supports Israel or Zionism is invited to speak on campus. So University UC Berkeley Law School is creating what is in effect a Jew-free zone on their campus, and that doesn't rise to anybody's attention. Anybody want to tackle this one?
My understanding is that late last night, the dean of Berkeley Law School wrote a very aggressive piece. I think it was in the Daily Beast. I just haven't read it yet. It was, again, late night and now early morning, pushing back on it, saying that's not exactly what happened. Regardless, this is a problem, too. One of the problems with the Jewish community, as I see it, and I've written quite a bit about this, is that the Jewish community is stuck between a rock and a hard place. They have long cared about social justice, but don't want the mob to turn on them. The result of which is they tend to be very quiet when this stuff happens, when it's blatantly illegal, un-American, and very, very scary.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's stunning. But again, this is where we are. And as Andrew Sullivan wrote last year, we're all on a college campus now, so you better pay attention. Sam Abrams, professor of politics at Sarah Lawrence, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Sam, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. SecDef Lloyd Austin spoke with Fareed Zakaria. He only likes home field interviews, like most of the Biden administration. The topic, Russia and Ukraine, the question whether or not Lloyd Austin has been talking to his counterpart in Russia, and Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu, and if there's been communication about the prospect of Putin using nukes. Here's what Austin said about that.
Personally, I've not talked to Shoigu in recent days, but I have talked to him in the past, and I have addressed this very issue to warn to not go down his path and conduct this type of irresponsible behavior. So, yes, I have done that in the past personally, but I've not talked to him recently.
Did you get the sense he got it? You felt like he heard your message?
I do think he heard my message, but to be clear. The guy who makes that decision, I mean, it's one man. There are no checks on Mr. Putin. Just as he made the irresponsible decision to invade Ukraine, he could make another decision. But I don't see anything right now that would lead me to believe that he has made such a decision.
All right. So what should we be doing so he doesn't make that decision in the affirmative to use tactical nuclear weapons? Representative Mike Turner, Republican from Ohio, is the ranking member of the House Intel Committee. He was on with Maria Bartiromo yesterday, and he had this to say about one of the things we should be doing.
This administration needs to step up its game on missile defense. We have assets in Europe. We need to engage them so that they can provide protection to our allies, including Ukraine. We need to move other missile defense assets into the area so that we're not just a casual observer if Putin makes good on these threats and we see a catastrophic use of weapons of mass destruction by Putin.
For more on this, please be joined for our weekly conversation by Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, VP of the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation and author of Brutal War, Jungle Fighting in Papua New Guinea, 1942. Jim, what do you say in response to what you've heard from Secretary Austin and Representative Turner?
Yeah, let me take a little different tack for your listeners. From somebody who was in the tactical nuclear weapon business for most of my military career. I was in the military for 25 years. The entire first half of my career was in tactical nuclear weapons, either training, exercising, or planning how to use them. So I do have a bit of practical experience on how this works. So the first thing I would say is tactical nuclear weapons have very limited utility. Because in the end of the day, they're just a big boom. And it's not really the, oh, my God, radiation. But it makes it harder to move around the battlefield. It wrecks everything. Obviously, in the place where it goes off, there's radiation that's very high, and you have to kind of walk around that. It messes up your electronic communications. So it's not a preferred tactical weapon of choice because it creates as many problems as it solves. If you're going to use tactical nuclear weapons, the time to use them is when you're on the offense, not on the defense. And the NATO planners, when we only planned on defensive use of tactical nuclear weapons against the Soviet invasion, it was super hard to figure out how to do this. Particularly when you're being rolled up like the Russians are now, the front lines are changing. Wherever you plan that weapon, by the time you get around to employing it, there might be nobody there. So the other thing is you have to be trained to operate in a nuclear environment. The Russian military is not. It's been decimated. It's throwing people into the line without uniforms. They're telling people to take tampons in case they're shot, so they have something to plug the holes with. So the odds are if the Russians fired a tactical nuclear weapon, half the Russian army would just jump up and run away. Matter of fact, that actually, in 1956, during the Hungarian invasion, when the Russians were chasing Hungarian military refugees, a grain silo exploded. And it created this massive mushroom cloud, because you can actually make a mushroom cloud with a conventional explosion. The Russian tank column that was following them thought the Allies were firing nuclear weapons at them, and they literally turned back and ran away, which is how the Hungarians escaped. This is so the notion that somehow – and the idea that he's going to pop some weapons and the Hungarians are just going to – I mean, the Ukrainians are just going to throw up their arms and quit. That's nonsense. I was just in Ukraine. Ukrainians are going to fight even harder. And Putin would go from being sanctioned like he is now to being isolated like North Korea. So could he do this? Absolutely. Does it make sense to do this from an actual military standpoint? If he doesn't want to lose more ground in Ukraine, if he doesn't want to the Ukrainians to get more military aid, and if he doesn't want to lose faster, it would be really stupid.
So should we do what Representative Turner said with missile defense systems or not?
Well, I don't think it's physically possible to deploy missile defenses fast enough to actually impact Putin's decision-making. And it's very – the least likely scenario is that he would actually fire tactical nuclear weapons at NATO territory. Having said that, I'm a strong believer in conventional and strategic deterrence. And to me, it's like, well, you yahoos, why haven't you been boosting missile defense for the last 15 years? You have to remember, we had a robust plan for missile defense of Europe that Bush put on the table. And the first thing Obama did was come in and kill it. And then he replaced it with a piece of paper that's taken a decade and a half not to even robustly implement. So the Democratic presidents have been deaf on missile defense. And so calling on Biden to ramp it up, to me, sounds like a bit of a forlorn hope. And we'd have to build these. I mean, we don't have infinite missile defense capacity. But the reality is any idiot who's looking at the world that we live in 20 years ago would have been heavily investing in more missile defense. And we didn't because Democrats don't like it.
Well, over the weekend, Putin had this public signing declaring the annexation of certain parts of Ukraine from that sham election that they had. How is Ukraine going to respond to it?
Well, sorry, I don't mean it's not funny.
No, it's not funny.
But even as he made that declaration, the territory that they declared independent or part of Russia was falling back into Ukrainian hands. And so the Russians are now in the very awkward position of saying, well, we're not exactly sure what liberated territories have joined the country of Russia because it keeps changing every day. And a major city, which they said was liberated by the Russians, the next day they said, well, it's not actually included in Russian territory. And today the Russians actually put out a statement that says, well, we don't have a clear boundary. So the declaration was really, it was meant to scare people, but again, it seems like out of weakness, just like the mobilization. It was meant to scare people, but then when they saw what they did, it actually just made everybody laugh at the Russians. Even the threat of nuclear weapons, where he says, I'm not bluffing. Well, who do you know who's not bluffing, who says I'm not bluffing?
Right. What about blowing up the Nord Stream pipeline? Is that more likely than not Putin's work as well?
Look, here's what we know. The Russians
Nord Stream pipeline, if KJP says.
Yeah, right. There are two of them, right? Well, look, we know they were sabotaged, right? Because you have the two pipelines simultaneously, very similar incidents. It had to be sabotaged. We know the Russians have the capability to do that. We know they're not losing money because of it, because the gas isn't flowing. We know that they can actually be repaired. Even the Russians have said that. We know that they've been looking for every demonstrable way to spook the West. And I know people have different theories about other people doing it, but there is no demonstrable evidence for anybody else doing it. And it really, from a practical standpoint, doesn't make sense for anybody else to do it. So, it is, you know, kind of a logic train that the most likely answer is the Russians. I'm sorry.
I know you're up against it, but I just want to get you to react to something. Our climate czar, speaking of Russian royalty, John Kerry had to say on Morning Joe about our relationship with the Chinese communists as it pertains to, of course, saving the planet from climate change.
China has a plan. They put a plan in place. We think they could be doing more. But China is going to be building more electric vehicles, will be put on the road over the next year or so in China, than in all the rest of the world put together. China is, I'm not excusing China, I'm just telling you that China is moving to do additional things. They are deploying renewable power at a rate that exceeds all other nations. They are the largest manufacturer of renewables in the world. And so China is moving. The challenge is that if we're not cooperating together, which we're not able to be doing right now, since Taiwan, the Taiwan visit, look, China has suspended its communications with us on this subject. I hope they're going to come back, and I hope we can work together.
We need to work together.
Look, over the life cycle, an electric vehicle has a higher carbon footprint than a conventional vehicle. So anybody who claims that building electric vehicles is actually reducing greenhouse gases is lying. All those technologies are actually dirtier than conventional electricity. He didn't mention that they're building more coal plants than anybody else. He didn't mention that the pollution is actually going up or down. He's basically lying to the American people. And I would really hope that the first thing that happens when Congress changes, among the many priorities they have, is to actually investigate him and his office and figure out why he is actually lying to the American people and pushing on them an agenda which is obviously political. It isn't, has nothing to do with energy, has nothing to do with the environment, has nothing to do with national security, and why he's actually arguing for a position that would endanger American safety and the economy. This man has become literally one of the most dangerous people on earth.
Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, Heritage Foundation. Thanks as always, Jim.
See ya.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560. The Answer.
This was a fun moment over the weekend. The damage control that the leftists were doing with the Biden-Harris week between Where's Jackie and our good friends, the North Koreans.
Oh, yeah. Keep on delivering every day.
Simone Sanders was on Meet the Press with that yapping terrier who services the left.
I thought he was going to be leaving soon because his ratings are way down.
Yeah, well. Whatever. Yeah. We'll go the way of David Gregory. We'll see. It'd be nice. But they'll just replace him with another, you know, flunky to repeat the talking points of the left. And this was fun how they nicely dispatched with the Where's Jackie moment. Simone Sanders was a mouthpiece for Comrade Bernie, then for Mr. 10%, the big guy, President Biden. Now she's got some, I don't know, half-baked show on MSNBC or something. And she was asked to do damage control, both on Where's Jackie as well as KJP's ridiculous spin.
Because it was top of mind. She was top of mind.
She was top of mind, but he didn't know that she was gone. Right, yeah. She was bringing back the dead. Remembering her legacy and all that. Right, okay. So this is how they nicely tied it up. It's a real master class. Take a listen.
Look, Karine Jean-Pierre has a very tough job, and I think she goes out there every single day, and a number of people could not do what she does every day. Look, I think it's very clear that the president had the slip of the tongue, obviously, and I'm sure he is extremely apologetic to the family of the congresswoman if he caused them any more trauma or agony. No one, I think everyone understands that the president, unfortunately, uniquely understands how the family is feeling, and I'm sure he made that very clear to them when they came to the White House on Friday. I think just to acknowledge it, he had a slip of the tongue, move on. It's unfortunate. Again, life is here. Yeah. He understands.
Life is here.
And empathize. I think that's what's most important here. And I think Karine did try to do that.
People make mistakes and you try to.
Yeah. It is like we've all done it before.
No, we haven't.
No, we all have.
We don't make it. We respect the dead and we know who is dead and we remember who has passed. It was so weird.
Yeah, I like the Chuck spin particularly. It's just a mistake. It's just a slip of the tongue. Is it? Is that what we know from watching Joe Biden low these many years? That it's not something that sort of is fundamental to his capacity?
Well, he has a cognitive disability, I think.
No, he's just dumb. He's just dumb, and he's always been dumb. He was dumb when he was elected when he was 29 years old, and he has been a room temperature intellect and a fabulist for the last 50 years. That's who he is. All this cognitive decline and all this. Whatever. It doesn't matter. All this like armchair diagnosis, I've said it during the campaign when Trump was doing it, totally unhelpful. Still is. Hold somebody in the position of leader of the free world responsible for what they actually do. Just responsible for their behavior rather than trying to divine into something you have no idea. Right? Hold people responsible for what they actually do as opposed to suppositions and rationalizations about why they do it. Is that so difficult when it comes to political leaders? I mean, I know it is in this state. We see it. But he's this, he's that. That's excuse making is what that is. You're helping Biden. You're not helping to change the way in which people assess their political leaders, which I thought was the point. Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We call them heroes, and then we watch as they get treated like goats. And I don't mean greatest of all time. Coast Guard hero thanked by Biden. Zach Loesch was thanked by President Biden. He kicked through a wall to pull a disabled woman and her husband who were marooned in their storm-smashed home in Florida. I'm just trying to smile and be happy and show up to them as a light at the end of their dark day. A lot of them are desperate, need help, and in despair, everything they know is gone. And when they're leaving with us, it may be the last time they see their house, said Loesch. President Biden congratulated Loesch for his bravery in helping rescue people in Southwest Florida. Biden saying, I told him how proud of him I was and thanked him for all the work he and his coasties are doing to save lives. Is that what they're called, or did Biden make that up? I haven't heard that before. Coasties?
I don't like it.
It's weird.
Let's not use it again. It's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Is he trying to be hip or something?
Yeah. Oh, by the way, Zach Loesch?
Yeah.
He is about to be discharged from the Coast Guard because of the COVID vaccine mandate.
Why do we still even have him in place?
Hey, Zach, great job. Great job, Loeschi. Thank you so much. You're a hero. And you're fired.
Thanks for saving the coasties, Loeschi, and now you're gone. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. It's almost as if they know what they're doing is wrong, but they dug their heels in so deep that they can't reverse it. It just come up, be a man or be a leader and just come out and say, you know what? We were wrong and we're going to change this now. Because the latest science and data has proven that, you know, that even if you get vaccinated, there's still a high probability that you're going to get COVID or give it to somebody else.
Or even just, you know, now you have to admit you're wrong. You're just, we're beyond that stage now. You could have some sort of cover story so that people don't have to be sacrificed on the altar of your ideology. But no, that's not going to happen. Laura Morgan, it's a nurse. Been a nurse for 39 years. She writes in the Wall Street Journal, I was fired from my nursing job this year for refusing to take implicit bias training. After 39 years of providing equal care to all my patients without regard to their race, I objected to a mandatory course grounded in the idea that I'm racist because I'm white. And she fears that every healthcare professional will soon be forced to make the same awful decision. Falsely admit to being a racist or abandon the medical field. When we were talking to Sam Abrams from Sarah Lawrence at the bottom of the 6 o'clock hour, I read you that oath that the aspiring doctors at the University of Minnesota Med School crafted for them to recite, like good sentinels of the race-hustling identitarian politicians who lord over our cultural, civic, and professional institutions. The situation with Laura Morgan, maybe it's similar to what others have experienced, and they've decided to, and I'm not passing judgment, but they've decided to participate in a lie. They've decided to help propagate a lie. Laura Morgan is deciding the opposite. She doesn't want to live a lie. Admit to being a racist. I'm not, so I'm not going to admit to that. Or abandon the medical field. So that's what she chose after nearly four decades.
At a time when we need nurses the most. Used to be heroes, remember?
The idea of implicit bias, for those unfamiliar, we've talked about it many times on the show. It's completely without foundation. It's completely without scientific support. And it's continuing to make its way into every nook and cranny of existence in America in terms of your professional workplace settings. The idea of implicit bias, Laura Morgan properly recounts, is the belief that white people treat those who aren't white worse than those who are. It's part of the woke assumption that society, including healthcare, suffers from, say it with me, systemic racism. Accordingly, my own supposed implicit bias, which is a euphemism for ingrained racism, must be rooted out. Not only that, it must be replaced with preferential treatment for the non-white. I fail to see how real racial discrimination is justified by my non-existent racism. Yeah, that is confusing. That is a logic that's difficult to follow. Perhaps Reparation H could help explain it to you while she's talking about the hurricane's systemic racism and how people of color need to be prioritized by FEMA. She said, I knew it was coming, but I was still devastated when I was fired in February. I went from a six-figure job to zero income.
That's rough.
And she's trying to find a new healthcare job. No one will hire her. No doubt if they contacted my old employer, they were told why I was let go. I thought there was a nursing shortage.
There is.
She also points out that this is happening everywhere in her profession. As of July, the Kentucky Board of Nursing requires all registered nurses take a continuing ed course on implicit bias. Nurses are told implicit bias kills, that's a quotation, and that white privilege is a, quote, covert form of racism. The course walks the nurses through their possible contributions to, quote, modern day lynchings in the workplace, unquote. That's grounded, isn't it? Modern day lynchings in the workplace. That's what you need instruction on in order to be a nurse. Michigan started requiring all professional license holders to take 2 hours of implicit bias training. Everyone from doctors and nurses to dentists and counselors. The training must be taken at every license renewal. Massachusetts mandated implicit bias training for doctors in June. No state board of medicine or nursing provides sufficient evidence to support the claim that all white people are implicitly biased, and there's plenty of scholarly research that shows that implicit bias testing is flawed. She's right. We've gone over it. Doesn't matter. More state mandates are surely on the way, including in red states. Most state medical associations which exert a powerful influence over policy, have bought into the belief that their own members are racist. Yeah, maybe you members of the Illinois Medical Association. Maybe you want to check in. The Illinois Nurses Association, you want to check in. The Texas Nurses Association declares the existence of, quote, racial biases in healthcare, unquote, and supports implicit bias training for nurses. No one, not me, my peers, or our patients will be better off if more states call us liars and racists. No, Laura Morgan is not going to participate in a lie. It's tough, though. I know. It's tough to watch, you know, it's tough to do what she did. She's got 40 years in. Maybe she can afford to walk away, although it doesn't sound like it. She's looking for another job. She also wrote that she sold her car to make sure she'd have enough money to live on. So it doesn't sound like she's sitting around with money to burn.
No.
But she did it anyway because she doesn't want to live a lie. She's not going to defile herself by saying, I'm a racist when I'm not a racist.
The bills don't stop coming, that's for sure.
Jack in Whiting, Indiana.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I really love your show. I know a few Chicago firemen and a few policemen in Chicago. There's a handful of them. There's a few military guys, examples, the Coast Guard, that refuse to get this mandated hoax vaccination. And they're not using religious reasons. They just don't want to get it. How can we come to the aid of these few that have, they got 10, 15, 20 years experience? How can we come to their aid to fight this, to be in their corner?
Well, thanks for the call, Jack. I mean, one of the ways you can do it at the city level here, like using Chicago as an example, is, and this, and first responders could do this, is put pressure on the aldermen. Put pressure on the alder wardens, as somebody recently, a phrase that somebody recently used to describe the aldermen. These 50 trained SEALs, the alder wardens, because they really are. They're like wardens in their local prison. That's how Chicago's organized. The feudal state, feudalism. Alder wardens, I like that better. But, you know, they are, and by the way, you got an election coming up, February and April.
You can make a difference.
You put pressure on them. You tell them, you get organized, and you tell them that if I see officers being fired, if we see officers being fired because they wouldn't comply with the vax mandate, then, you know, we're going to turn you out.
Oh, and here's what they're doing. I know a firefighter hasn't been to church in decades. He got a religious exemption. So we're perpetuating this lie. We're learning how to lie just to keep our jobs, which is sickening.
And we talked about this again. We've talked about this many times. I don't know how deeply it penetrates, but one of the hallmarks of a society that is not free is that you live a different life publicly than you do privately. And this is an observation that you hear often from those who lived in Eastern Bloc countries, who were behind the Iron Curtain. You know what the truth is privately, but you have to live a lie publicly. Is that how you want to live? Maybe some people need to be challenged about that. I know some people have given in to the lies, and because the human being has the infinite capacity to rationalize even untruths and say their truths. But a lot of people are just living two lives, one private life and one public life. Is that the way you want to live? If it's not, you better tell somebody. And perhaps move some people out of the positions they've enjoyed. Move some people out who are sentinels for the lying class. All the acceptable lies that we tell ourselves, that they tell us to repeat, and the unacceptable truths we're willing to say out loud. Susan, Cedar Lake, Indiana.
Hi, big fan. Listen every day. I'm a nurse, too. 39 years, I'll be 60 next year. I can't wait to get out of this darn field. I was written up because I'm a pediatric nurse. I used the wrong pronouns, and this punk reported me saying that I said, hi, guys.
Oh, come on. Really?
No,
Not kidding. I left that hospital, but it's happening everywhere. My sister works at Loyola. Same thing. She had to take training. We already have cultural training. We treat everybody. We don't care if you're dying. We're going to help you. We don't look at skin color.
Right.
We have great diversity in healthcare, and it's just nursing is so, it's horrible. We're so short of help. I'm working double shifts all the time. I can't wait to leave. Well, all these other people are sitting home. I don't know how they can afford not to work. I mean, I'm 59 years old, and I'm running my butt off, you know,
yeah,
and getting in trouble for saying, hi, guys. Well, right. You have to identify their pronouns before now. You know, when you get registered to go in a hospital, you can refuse to say your gender, so we don't know what to say. We have to, you know, walk on eggshells and say, you know, what does he or she prefer? Is this, you know, she identifies as what? So she's, you know, we have to ask what organs that you were born with do you still have?
Really? Yes. You know, I was told that you should say hello, friends.
Hello, friends.
That's acceptable.
When we document their sexual identity, we have to document what organs were they born with and what organs do they still have. Because it's important. If you have to go into someone's abdomen in an emergency, you want to know if there's a uterus in there. But if they say, oh, no, I'm not a woman, yes, you are, because you have a uterus that the physician may cut into in an emergency. You know what I mean?
Then it's sort of like it's like a Cracker Jack box. Look, there's a uterus. yeah.
And a mastectomy is a mastectomy. Quit calling it top surgery. Oh, this is top surgery. It sounds so
top and
easy.
Bottom.
It is a radical mastectomy, and it is a serious operation. It is nothing to, oh, it's top. I'm going to go have top surgery. No, you're not. You're having a radical mastectomy.
How many transgenders have you run into?
Many, many. Every day there's a couple.
Really?
And I had a girl, oh my gosh, she was 19, taking testosterone and just cutting herself all up because she had depression. And, you know, she ended up being, she was molested as a child, you know, didn't want to be a girl anymore. So now she's a guy. And, you know, they always pick names that you can't choose. You can't decide whether it's a female.
It's Pat.
That's what I say.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Yeah.
Kim is a girl's name and Bob is a boy's name. They pick out names like Dax, you know, D-A-X or... Or something that's just like you can't tell. Like, you know, Dan is a Dan and Amy's an Amy.
Right.
But I love you guys. I love your show. Just keep going. I moved to Indiana. I got out of the swamp and I love it here. So,
all right. At least you got that going for you. Thanks for the call, Susan. Keep it up with the nursing. We appreciate that. Appreciate you. Friends? No. You have to earn the description friend.
That's what I was trained to.
Humans. Hi, human.
Hi. Oh.
Yeah, use humans. Hey,
hello, humans.
Hi, humans.
Is that offensive in any way?
I mean, I guess if you identify like as a dragon.
Alien?
No, there are people identify as animals, right? You have furries.
Right.
You have furries at the high school level. We were talking about this with a friend over the weekend. Like literally where there's a high school here that where the kid wants a litter box.
Yeah, where is it? Because I keep going back and forth with something. That's not true. I checked the internet. That's not true.
Well, they have furry conventions. It is true.
They do have right. And when furry conventions, they do have litter boxes.
There's no question. And so why shouldn't a young human be able to identify as a dog or a giraffe or whatever?
A cat.
And then, and dictate the terms of his... of the human or the giraffe or the water buffalo or whatever, their environment, right? So just like we have tampons in the boys' room, why not a litter box? Why not a special? I mean, either integrate it however the person wants to integrate it, or you create a litter box section, but only if that doesn't feel isolating to the furry.
Well, I do know a woman who goes into a salon near the house who... let them know that she's part cat. So she'll just go, meow, while she's talking. You know, yeah, this is what I did yesterday. Meow, meow. And we're in a conversation.
And and what school is she the principal of? Lee and Hammond, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, guys. You know, personally, the way I feel about this, it's got nothing to do with sensitivity toward different groups or anything like that. From day one, this is all about beating down your resistance, your critique of what they're forcing on you, and just acceptance whatever the dictates are that they're going to actually shove on society. That's basically what this is all about, and we need to attack it that way. I mean, nobody wants to be a racist. Nobody wants to disrespect anybody else, but they're using our guilt to actually beat us into submission this way, so we won't have any resistance to what they're trying to foist on the entire society.
Thanks for the call, Lee. And instead, speaking of heroes, here's something we should feel guilty about.
Mm-hmm.
Trump mentioned it at his rally in Warren, Michigan over the weekend. What we're doing in terms of conferring benefits and just deferring in general to these identitarian hustlers, to people in this country illegally. And when it comes to those who've served our country honorably, what are we doing? What are we doing? 22 per day. That's what I understand the number is, 22 veterans who commit suicide per day. Here is a veteran who is having a mental break on the side of the road in Connecticut. Connecticut State Trooper pulls over to help him. Take a listen and think about that. Think about how we are treating people who played by the rules. People who did everything right. People who sacrificed for themselves for you and me. And we're going to defer to these new Marxists. We're going to live public lies.
What's going on, boss? What's going on?
I'm about to fuck with the VA hotline.
Okay.
For suicide.
All right. Hey. Well, I got you, man, all right? What branch you in?
Army.
Yeah. All right, hey, my name's Kyle. All right, we'll help you out, all right, bud? I'm here with you, all right? I'm going to start an ambulance over here to us, okay? All right, bud? Hey, no, hey. If I send you, it's nothing on you, okay? State of Connecticut covers that, all right? Can we step out of the car, boss? Just so we can talk?
826.
Hey, come in the front of your truck, bud.
820.
Starting an ambulance to the 68 off ramp eastbound. I'm with a vet who's on the suicide hotline.
Here's my ID.
Sorry, man. Hey. Do you have anything on you?
No.
Okay, here's our vet check here. Cool. Any deployments, bud?
One.
Okay, dude. It's a tough time for everyone in your position, all right? Relax, though. Hey, I'm here with you, okay?
I'm here.
Come on, yeah.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy and ESG. We're talking about all the manifestations of neo-Marxism, the environmental social governance that is afflicting so much of corporate America because of the push by institutional heavyweights like, I don't know, Larry Fink at BlackRock and others. I'm starting to get some pushback. You know why? Performance. James Freeman over at Best of the Web column in the Wall Street Journal has been documenting this over the last week, too. I mentioned the poor performance of CalPERS, the country's largest public sector union pension fund, and how the California Public Employees Retirement System has underperformed the market because they're more obsessed with virtue signaling their investments than they are in providing return for their clients. Another example, interesting, I would have known this if Freeman didn't detail it, Unilever. Unilever, which is provides like Dove soap,
everything, yeah.
Ben and Jerry's ice cream. Yeah, the CEO is stepping down at the end of the year. Their share prices have lagged some of their rivals like Nestle and Procter & Gamble. And as Terry Smith, who's the CEO of Fundsmith, one of Unilever's largest shareholders, wrote in his letter to investors in January, a company which feels it has to define the purpose of Hellmann's mayonnaise has, in our view, clearly lost the plot. that is not exactly gentle. You know, no. It's not just mayonnaise. It's a social commentary.
Yeah.
And, shareholders are not enjoying the underwhelming returns because of the focus on virtue signaling leftism as opposed to profit maximization. Imagine that. For more on this and other related economic topics, please be joined by Carol Roth, former investment banker, entrepreneur, author of The War on Small Business, How the Government Used the Pandemic to Crush the Backbone of America. Carol, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yes, good morning. I'm just going to go on record. I never liked mayonnaise to begin with.
Well, yes. Perhaps you don't appreciate the sort of underlining philosophical importance of mayonnaise. And that's what the Unilever people, I guess, were trying to communicate. And consumers weren't buying it. What about where we are with ESG and some, at least some pushback now happening?
Yeah, no, it's definitely encouraging. You know, I think of ESG as corporate social credit. I think that's a good way for people to kind of get their heads wrapped around it. And, you know, there have been two sets of critiques related to it. One is the ones that you're talking about, that obviously corporations, particularly those that are publicly traded and have outside shareholders, their boards have a fiduciary duty to run the business to maximize the profits for those shareholders, which, by the way, is aligned, broadly speaking, with social goals. You cannot be a bad actor. You cannot treat your employees badly. You cannot treat your customers badly and not have the market sort that out on its own. So it's sort of this unnecessary layer of pushing, you know, the objectives of people who are not stakeholders. They like to call them stakeholder capitalism, but they're not actual stakeholders of the company in any way, shape, or form. And so there's that piece. And then there's also just the giant scam piece of it, that, you know, what is ESG according to whom? And if you look at some of the funds that have had ESG labels on them, you know, you're looking at, you're like, how is this any different than a tech fund? You had, you know, months ago, Elon Musk's Tesla kicked out of a major ESG fund while they put in some of the big fossil fuel companies because, you know, they didn't like what he was saying on Twitter. So, you know, it really is, you know, a little bit of a scam, and it's a way for people to extract, you know, that's part of the reason it's become entrenched, because there's so many profiteers that are sort of feeding at the ESG trough, if you will. But at the end of the day, your corporations are economic animals. You can do this nonsense when everything is going up, but when things are going in the opposite direction, there is a bit more scrutiny, and now you have folks in the C-suites, you know, some activist investors, you have AGs and governors across the country starting to push back. And so, you know, while, you know, we cannot say, yes, this is a victory, it certainly is a good step in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was a good exchange that was recounted by Michael Schellenberger in a piece he wrote in the Post, talking specifically about the energy sector, since that's the specific target for elimination by this administration. He recounts testifying before Congress and talking to Representative Ro Khanna, who's a socialist from California. He said to Schellenberger, the congressman, if there's a war on energy, how is Exxon, Chevron, BP, and Shell making over 200% profits? You can't have a war in an industry and then they're having record profits. And Schellenberger writes, the reason I told Khanna is precisely because the Biden administration has been stifling oil and natural gas production, thereby reducing supply and increasing prices and profits. This is like Econ 101, and it baffles the socialists on the Hill like Khanna.
Yeah, you just you have to wonder whether or not they're that stupid, or they're just, you know, purposely
diabolical.
Just diabolical and playing the naive card. I mean, neither is a good outcome for anybody. But it is true that whether it is, you know, some of the socialists and progressives that are in Congress, or even some of the corporate C-suite that has gotten caught up in this, a lot of people don't even know what they're pushing, and I think that's part of the issue. You know, as you had mentioned at the beginning of the segment, you know, you have some of these, you know, big, you know, bad actors that are very forceful like BlackRock that has a ton of assets under management and has, you know, come out over the past few years saying, you know, either you're basically you're with us or you're against us, and we're going to use our leverage to try and enforce this on you, or we're not going to invest in your companies. And as a CEO, you're trying to manage risk and you're trying to manage bad PR. And so they got a little bit bullied into sort of moving in this direction. But if you ask them, you know, what does this mean? They have no idea. It's just another one of those, you know, corporate mumbo jumbo things, not realizing how really nefarious and damaging this is. And, you know, as the market has come apart here, there has been more scrutiny and people have had to get a little bit more focused. But the thing that concerns me, guys, is that, you know, even if ESG starts to go away, it doesn't mean it goes away long term, or it doesn't mean that it doesn't get, you know, kind of resurrected under another name. They've tried to do this under multiple names. ESG is one of the latest, but they're starting to shift to things like impact investing. So, you know, they may declare ESG dead, but now it's this thing. And right. So, you know, it's kind of like that cockroach that never dies. You have to, you know, keep spraying the bug spray on it.
But how much of this, too, is corporations playing the game? They're running a scam on the scammers. In other words, when Chevron, you know, their Scope 3 proposal says its goal is to change oil companies from within by pushing big oil to go green. Right. So I don't know exactly how that's going to that transformation is going to happen. But me, it's just sort of pushing off the political parasites by, you know, repeating back to them the words they want to hear, even if maybe there's not as much internal transformation going on as those parasites would hope.
Absolutely. That's the thing. If you went to all of the publicly traded CEOs and you said, okay, so what really is ESG and what are you really doing and how is this really, you know, any different than what you've been doing before? I think you'd find that probably for the majority of those companies, it's not any different at all. It's just trying to manage that business risk, you know, the lack of bad PR, appeasing the money managers and all of these folks who are pushing it. Until the point that your customers, employees, and other purveyors of capital say, we want you going in the exact opposite direction, or else we're going to really, you know, raise our voices and give you a hard time. And then it's gonna shift in some direction. But there is a window now. People need to continue to be vigilant, write letters to the company's boards, to the company's management, you know, put things out on social media that says, you know, we love your product, you're doing the right thing, we want to be a shareholder, or we want to be a customer, but we don't want you to be focused on this weird corporate social credit, we want you to focus on the business. And I think that will give those, you know, C-level executives a little bit more comfort that they're doing the right thing by rejecting ESG.
But there's also a movement to stop people from banking at banks who support oil companies. Have you seen that movement?
I mean, there are movements for everything. I mean, it's like we're living in this weird sort of puritanical witch hunt kind of, but, you know, with a futuristic vibe. And yes, there are, you know, kind of all different kinds of things, whether it's at the corporate or personal level, to cut people off from all kinds of resources. And that's honestly, on the energy side, one of the reasons why we have this undersupply, in addition to what the Biden administration has done. His ESG cronies has directed capital away, particularly from the public companies. It's less of an issue in the private sector. You have more investment there. But we have not had enough investment, and particularly long-term investment, because if you have this witch hunt going after you, who wants to spend billions of dollars building a refinery or you know, exploring for oil when you have this threat of being shut down? So it really is impacting our economic and national security, and it's why we need more people to be vocal about it.
So we had the worst September in the market in two decades. Mortgage rates are up at 7%. You've got some equity analysts from the big banks and investment houses saying not only recession, and since we've had two straight quarters of contraction, that's sort of the working definition, despite what the big guy says, but they're also saying not just recession, but it could be something sort of worse when the earnings recession hits, and we're in uncharted territory, and a lot of sort of jumpy language out there, and I wonder what your prognostication is for the short term.
Well, I'm not going to be giving you any comfort this morning, Dan and Amy, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I think the important thing to remember is that this was deliberate. This was entirely done by monetary and fiscal and other government policy. And so this economic pain that everybody is feeling could have been avoided, whether it's, you know, through inflation, through, you know, losses in your 401k, you know, pension funds, whatnot. This could have been entirely avoided, but this is what central planning does. So, yes, not only are we in a recession, although this particular quarter we could eke out on a real basis, we could eke out a small gain. So there could be a small pause to that before we head back into this sort of recessionary place again. So that's something to just keep an eye on. But longer term, you know, not only have we not gotten to that point where we've seen the full effects of the slowdown in the economy, but there are all kinds of issues and contagions in the global economy. And the Fed's action vis-a-vis what's happening globally could engender a currency crisis, a liquidity crisis in the Treasury market, you know, all of these kinds of crazy things. And there's actually emergency closed door, unexpected Fed meeting that is happening today that all of a sudden was put on the schedule late last week. And we don't exactly know what's going to happen, but some of these issues that are happening and potential contagions certainly are a concern. And so what the Fed does from here, whether they lean into their policy or whether they take a pause, will give me a better sense of what their actual intentions are.
Well,
none of which, by the way, are good.
Well, right. And after what we saw happen to Liz Truss's very modest tax cuts and deregulation, that's been put to the side because of quote-unquote conservatives in the parliament there. But the hue and cry over the recklessness of what she had proposed and so on and so forth, which is just sort of, again, standard issue pro growth stuff. Boy, that it just says we're going to a bad place where central bankers, as long as even if you have an erstwhile center right party in charge, like in England, so the central bankers are running the show.
Yeah, the central bankers are running the show, and unfortunately, because they have created such a mess, that it's hard to put some of these policies in place because there are these other forces. I mean, even here in the U.S., you have a government that is working completely against the central banking policy. You have the central bankers who are taking, you know, very austere measures to try to slow the economy at the same time that you have Congress and the Biden regime spending like drunken sailors. So, you know, how does that foot against each other, and what kind of long-term issues does that create? And, you know, this is that chaos and that mess that comes out of central planning, and the people who end up losing are the average Americans. You know, not only is it debasing our currency long-term, but these boom and bust cycles really do favor those who have more assets and more capital on the sideline to take advantage of when the markets go down and be able to load up and benefit when it goes on the way back up, where the average person ends up losing out. And so this is the barbelling of our economy and really the hollowing out of the middle class, which is a terrible, terrible outcome.
She is Carol Roth, former investment banker, entrepreneur. The book, The War on Small Business, How the Government Used the Pandemic to Crush the Backbone of America. Carol, thanks as always.
Always great to be with you guys. Have a great week.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Some public health causes are more important than others. and K through 12. Obviously, we know how important COVID is, and saran wrapping the kids so they don't catch COVID, and putting them in a dungeon if they do. But not when it comes to lice, at least not if the American Academy of Pediatrics gets its way.
I can't believe this story.
The AAP, children who have lice are neither a health hazard nor not necessarily practicing poor hygiene. They should not be sent home because
what?
Sending children home due to head lice can result in psychological stress and significant stigma. The guideline states school exclusion of children or adolescents with NITs alone. NITs?
That's what they call them. Because you get the bun then by the NIT kit to pull out the lice.
I wouldn't know.
I wasn't a dirty kid. Okay, my kids both had lice, and we're not
dirty kids.
No, we're not. Don't get that stink. Don't put
dirty
that stink
kids.
On
oh,
me.
Stigma.
Stigma. No, no.
It stinks.
But
hey.
Everybody, have you ever seen it, though? Because you can watch them.
No.
I've seen this. They can jump. You can see them jumping from your hair to a kid next door or right near them.
Sounds like fun. AAP,
gross.
School exclusion of children or adolescents with NITs alone would have resulted in many of these children or adolescents missing school unnecessarily.
Oh,
heavens forbid anybody miss school unnecessarily. I mean, these are like comedy writers. In addition, head lice infestations have been shown to have low contagion in classrooms.
Oh, that's not true. Yeah. If someone has lice, the majority of the class eventually get lice.
If they
have darker, thicker hair, like my one son has darker hair than my other one. And
isn't your child getting lice a small price to pay to prevent another child from potentially suffering any stigma? Unnecessarily missing a day or two of school?
Having to take a bath finally?
What? How do you get lice out again? What do you, like, do you bathe in tomato soup or something?
No, that's skunk. There's a shampoo now. You put it in and then you take a knit kit with a certain kind of brush and you pull.
Shave the kid's head?
No, you pull the
Why
lice.
You just shave
you pull the
kid's
eggs.
Head.
No, you pull the eggs out of their
pull
hair.
Pull the eggs. Oh, my God.
Yeah, they're
God.
Eggs.
Disgusting.
And then you
oh,
do the next one and the next.
And they let your son into Georgia Tech after he had that affliction?
He had lice in third grade.
That's disgusting.
But his whole classroom, the majority of his class had it too. So.
Well, no need to worry about kids with lice roaming around the school halls. But obviously, if there's anybody who's not wearing a surgical mask, which, as we know, has no impact on transmission, then there's something to worry about. And even if you win in a court of law, as our next guest did, the right to have your son not forced to comply with the mask mandate in the Chicago Public Schools, for example. Pleased to be joined now by Claudia Vardis Dabrowski. Claudia, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Amy. Thank you so much for having me on your show to tell my son.
All right. So,
experience.
Yeah. So what's going on? You were one of the parents who sued her school district. Part of this class action.
Yes. We were on the Thomas DeVore.
Right. And so Tom DeVore, and then you got the judge to say, yeah, Claudia's kid doesn't have to wear a mask. So now what's happening?
Yeah. CPS continues with their senseless act. They claim that if there's a COVID case in the classroom, the new policy, which we all know policy is not a law, the whole class is required for 10 days to wear a mask. I mean,
and it's regardless, sorry for jumping in, but it's regardless of vaccination status. If anybody in your class is tested positive, the whole class for 10 days.
The whole class.
But certain schools aren't enforcing this. It's like press release politics. They'll send parents a notification, but there's no masking police going around. But at your son's school, Chicago Academy Elementary, that's different.
It's different for that school.
Is your son sent to some Siberia within within CPS somewhere, or what happens?
They putting him in the corner. Basically, they asked him to put his desk aside, away from his peers.
That sounds like stigmatizing. Yeah.
Yes, he stated, "I want to sit with my friends." So immediately as I was waiting, I got a call from the school telling me that he either has to mask or he has to go remote. There was no other option.
Mm-hmm. And can you handle remote, or don't you have a job where you can't be with him because he is in fifth grade?
I can handle remote, but I work. I can't be at home.
Well, not,
am I supposed to?
Well, not only that, it's not the ideal circumstance for your son, as we know from the as we know from all the research about the impact of remote learning on these kids. So, so then, you know, how do you respond to somebody who says, "Well, wait a second. So, you know, if it's the policy that if somebody gets COVID, then everybody has to wear a mask for 10 days who's been in contact, blah, blah, blah. Why don't you just do it? Because if you don't do it, then the school could come over the top and reinstitute universal masking."
Well, that's not the point. I mean, he suffered so much. Last year, he was sent home on a weekly basis to the doctor for malaise because he couldn't breathe correctly. He couldn't, he got headaches. It's just him. What am I supposed to tell him? You have to wear it. I mean, we can't force him. I can't force him. And I'm not going to have him all just skip 10 days of school and miss all that.
What is the solution? Do they want him? They want him to do remote learning, so there's still that's a possibility?
They can request it. They have told us that unless a kid is a disability, they cannot. Nobody else can request remote learning. But now it's just he must or he remote learn for the 10 days.
And what about the other parents that you speak with? Where are they in all this stuff? Or are they just, is everybody just like sort of looking out for their own?
I'm sorry, keep it that question.
So where are the parents of the other kids that your son goes to school with on this? Are you guys sort of rallying together, or is it just sort of every man and woman for themselves?
Everybody's on for themselves. I mean, they are upset that they're messing the kids. There was an instance where a student did not wear one in her classroom when the rest of them were, and she was not told anything. I mean, I don't know if it was by teacher as well. Some teachers are a little more lenient than others. Maybe the instance, I don't know.
Well, how is your son feeling through all of this?
He feels left out when they tell him that he's got to go to the office. Like, why should I get kicked out? I don't have COVID. I'm not going to give anybody COVID. That's his thinking.
So do the other parents understand how silly this policy is and how it has sort of no basis in science that we know to date through any number of studies about the transmission and the sort of likelihood of serious illness among this cohort of grammar schoolers? Do they like get the joke and they're like, yay, this is just how we got to sort of just, you know, do this to get by. We just got to play by their rules. Or are they like enthusiastic and they think they're doing something important and they think you're wrong and they're saving lives and you're not?
Most just say, well, it's just something we have to do. That's all they say. They just have to do it.
So they're not rabid about it. They're just like, this is what we got to do to keep our kids in school.
Yeah, a lot of parents, I think they're afraid of even speaking out.
Of course
they're
afraid.
Or speaking up, or just in case school or teachers or, I don't know, whoever in the school retaliates against their child.
So what happened today?
I'm afraid, too.
What are you afraid of?
I'm afraid retaliation against my child, like, I don't know, like I said, punishing him like they are for choosing not to wear a mask, which is his First Amendment, right? And he understands this, and he knows the risk of COVID. We have family that have COVID. We have relatives that passed away with COVID. And he knows the risk. And I have to support him. I cannot just say him just because they say mask. I can't force him.
And you said he was suffering ill effects health-wise from having to wear the mask?
Yes, he would call me and say, Mom, I have a headache. Or he will tell the school, I have a headache. They immediately send him to the care room, send him on his way home with a COVID form that he had to test to come back. I said, I'm going to take him to his doctor. His doctor checked him, and he said he's good to go. He doesn't need to test. This is just malaise. It's just a headache from wearing the mask.
What about the teachers? Any teachers standing up for him?
No.
No.
None.
What about the principal?
No.
No.
No. All they say is they're following protocol, and following this is orders. What they have to do. Yeah.
So then what happened today when you dropped him off at school?
I did the drop-off line. I got home. I was waiting for you guys to call, and Dan, they left a message saying that they have my son in the office because he refused to mask, and now it's either has to mask or I have to request remote learning.
Oh, my God. And what was your response to them? What are you going to do?
What I'm going to tell them, I tell them all the time is you have to leave my child in the classroom. He's not a threat to anyone. He's healthy. He cannot be excluded from something that he doesn't have or something that he doesn't have.
Mm-hmm.
And so is he sitting in the office right now as we speak?
Yes, and he is.
Well, what about, can you get Tom DeVore on it? Or is it, I mean, this isn't the first time. I have another friend who goes to Blaine and her kids, you know, after they won the lawsuit, it didn't matter. They kicked him out of the school anyway.
No, as Tom has said before, he cannot do anything for the blanket policy, I think they're calling it.
Yeah.
Which they signed for universal masking, not for COVID exposure.
Right, it's sort of they're technically operating within the
now
law.
Now I get it.
Yeah, technically, I mean it's violative of the spirit and violative of all good sense, but technically legal.
Yeah. I had my doctor sign our religious exemption form for vaccination and masking. I handed it into the school, and they're violating it. They're not respecting it. I mean. And the Illinois Constitution, Article 1, Section 3, free exercise and enjoyment of religious expression without discrimination, is covering one's faith intrudes on the religious expressions of an individual. It's just breaking the law. They're not respecting our religious. It cannot be denied. And they are denying it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's what the law says, and then there's getting it enforced in the state. Those are often two very different things, unfortunately. Claudia Vardis Dabrowski, thanks so much for joining us. Best of luck with your son. Sorry you're having to deal with those folks, such as they are, within CPS. It's tough, but best of luck to you.
I mean, I want people to realize that I'm not the only one. We need to be asking the question, who has the authority on all this? Who gave CPS authority to do this to our kids? I asked the assistant principal to give me the contact information for the person who's given him that authority, and he said he cannot provide his contact information. So, I'm not getting answers.
Well, I mean, you go right to the superintendent, I guess. I don't know.
They're not answering either.
Of course not.
Phone calls, messages.
No, of course not.
And this isn't going to end. I mean, I don't know when this silliness is going to end anytime soon. I think this is
we are still living
like this in perpetuity.
We still are under emergency order.
Oh, that's
so,
right.
You know,
right.
You got that. All right. This is the way that we want to live as a city. We'll see. Not all of us, I understand, Claudia, but we'll
all
see.
Right,
we'll
you.
See. Claudia Vardis Dabrowski, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and Amy, and this is a fun ad.
All right. What do you got boss?
That Cro-Magnon man who's running for Senate in Pennsylvania, John Fetterman.
Have you ever seen him without a hoodie and cargo shorts on? Because it's very bizarre.
Well, he's never had a job. He can't afford an extensive wardrobe. It's only what mom and dad will pay for. I mean, at least until he got elected to office. I mean, and he'd more than mayor. Then he's got a few bucks. Fetterman, this is an ad that was made by a super PAC that's playing in the race on behalf of Oz, obviously, as you'll hear.
Oh, I can't wait.
But it's always fun when somebody comes up with a pretty good jingle, like an actual song for the 30-second spot as opposed to just the conventional spot. So take a listen, see if you like it.
There once was a man-child in a hoodie, pushing Marxist policy, setting violent prisoners free while borders overflow. Soon may the fetterman come to bring us radical socialism. One day when the nation is done, we'll wish we'd told him no. Soon may the fetterman come to bring us radical socialism. One day when the nation is done, we'll wish we'd told him no.
Our American Century is responsible for the content of this advertising.
That's pretty good, isn't it?
I want to see it now.
Yeah, it's pretty funny.
What does it look like?
And it has a, you know, it has that folksy feel. It's like, it sounds like Billy Joel's Downeaster Alexa or something. It has that that feel to it. I like yeah, not bad. It's fun.
All right.
Glad they're having fun out in Pennsylvania.
I'm going to have to look it up. All right, thanks so much for making us part of your morning. Thanks to George Hoffman, who's in for Justin Kosick, and Quinn McCarthy, who's here every day, couldn't do it without him. We're back here bright and early tomorrow morning at 5 a.m.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.